My name is Murray Levin, and on behalf of my partners and colleagues here at Pepper Hamilton, I'm really delighted to welcome you to one of our periodic luncheon forums. I will make just a few brief remarks and get us to the main event, and judging by this overflow crowd, I think that would be the smart thing to do. I'm going to ask you to turn off any cell phone or electronic gadget that you may have so as not to interrupt us during the next hour or so. And I want to say a word or two about the Middle East Forum and its mission. I think that I'm probably speaking to the initiated here, so I don't have to tell you very much, but basically we all know that the mission of the forum is both to define and promote American interests in the Middle East, and that includes, of course, helping the United States to defend against Islamist threats. And there are all kinds of ways that that is carried on. I noted from some notes that were offered to me by the ubiquitous Amy Chargell that the three P's would actually define the way we do this. Publications, many of which you receive, either hard copy or online. Projects, such as the Campus Watch and other projects that you are knowledgeable about. And one that maybe is not as well known is philanthropic activities whereby we fund and help other like-minded groups and individuals to forward the mission that we are working on. Okay, let me just say a word about our featured and honored guest. I think you know that Ephraim Karsh is one of the leading historians of the Middle East. I personally have tremendously enjoyed two of his books, an older book, which I think was Empires of the Sand, and his most recent book, a 2010 Yale University publication, Palestine Betrayed. And by the way, we will have copies of Palestine Betrayed outside of the conference room, and you can purchase a copy, and I think it will be inscribed by the author if we're lucky and can keep him here and keep his hand writing over the many copies which I expect will be sold after this speech. You may know Ephraim Karsh in many different roles. One is that he is the editor of our own Middle East Quarterly. He has lectured and taught at universities that are the very top of the list, and that would certainly include Columbia, the London School of Economics, various departments at Harvard. He's done things at King's College, where he presently is a professor. He also is a very prolific writer. I mentioned two of his books, and I believe he's written closer to a dozen. Others were Arafat's War, Islamic Imperialism, and again, I'll mention the current book, Palestine Betrayed, which I think you'll find is a really terrific read and deals with so many sources from the Palestinian side that show a repeated pattern, if I may say, of sabotaging hopes for coming to agreements and peace, and actually sabotaging, I think it's fair to say, the majority view many times held by the Palestinians themselves. So without any further ado, let me welcome, and in a way it's a little bit of a reunion for me, because I had a great visit with Ephraim Karsh some years ago in Helsinki, and I'm delighted to welcome him to Pepper Hamilton and to the Middle East Forum. Ephraim?
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here. I mean, it feels almost at home. I mean, spending so much time in Helsinki, coming over here to get some warmth and sun, and then you end up in really the same weather, if not worse. So at least this is familiar. The topic of my talk today is really about who wants a Palestinian state, and my answer is no one really, but what happened the other day is that A substantial batch of documents, about 1,600 documents, were released by Palestinian documents and documents relating to the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations were released by Al Jazeera Network together with the British Guardian newspaper, and they shed some light that I would like to refer to, so I'll change the order in which I plan to conduct my talk. I wanted to start with the Palestinian leadership to show that even the Palestinian leadership is not really interested in a Palestinian state, but since we have these documents and there may be some indications, perhaps, and we'll discuss them at the end of the talk, that there may be some change, so I'll start with the easier part, which is the Arab states, which never wanted a Palestinian state and in fact did their utmost to sabotage it throughout history from the beginning of the 20th century when the new Middle East, modern Middle East was established, up to the present day. Now, obviously this is not the common view. In this document that I just referred to, there is one relating to President Mahmoud Abbas's visit to Washington in June 2009, and before he went to speak to President Obama, he had a meeting with the chief of the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. And according to this document, Admiral Mullen told Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen, as he is known, "You are the most important person in the Middle East. Arabs and Muslims have only one thing on their mind, and this is Palestine. So we want to help you establish a Palestinian state." Then he goes on to say, "I have 230,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we are bringing back 10 each week draped in American flags or in wheelchairs. This is painful for America. Because of this, I want to bring them back here. A Palestinian state is a critical interest of the United States." So in other words, if the Palestinians decide that they want to indulge or engage in state building instead of terrorism, those terrorists or militants, if you like, who are killing Iraqis throughout the country would stop killing them because, of course, the establishment of Palestinian state would, in a way, ameliorate their grievances. This is, of course, complete nonsense. I mean, the Arabs have never cared about Palestine and they have never wanted to promote any distinct Palestinian identity or national identity in the land that came to be known as Palestine. And let me just go very briefly. If you look to the east, there is Jordan. Jordan, or the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan as it is known, because it's ruled by a dynasty which came originally from the Hejaz, which is part of what is today Saudi Arabia. This is family related to the Prophet Muhammad. They carried out the Great Arab Revolt, the Lawrence of Arabia Arab Revolt in First World War, and were rewarded through the establishment of states on their behalf. Iraq was established in order to accommodate one member of this family called Faisal, the one that Lawrence liked most because he was most gullible. And Transjordan was established to pacify his elder brother, the far more astute, by the name of Abdallah. Originally it was an emirate, he was to rule it for a very short time, but eventually it came to be Jordan. And this Faisal and Abdallah, despite the fact that their brothers had rival ambitions to rule the Middle East, and of course Palestine was part of their envisaged empire. So if you look, for example, 1919, Faisal signed an agreement with Chaim Weizmann, head of the Zionist movement, in which he agreed to help implement the Balfour Declaration. A year later, it didn't suit his interest, so he was declared king of Syria for a while. And then Palestine was declared part of Syria, and there are riots in Palestine to promote the goal of its incorporation to Syria. Had he had his way already then, of course, the name Palestine would have disappeared from the map already in 1920. The same applied later to Abdallah, who established himself in Transjordan, east of the Jordan River. He negotiated with the Zionist movements many years, but he tried to convince them to become part of his kingdom because he saw the Jews were clever, they had money, they had influence, and it would be good to have them as subject of his empire. He didn't succeed, he attacked Israel when it was established in 48, and he annexed the territories in Judea and Samaria that came to be known subsequently as the West Bank of the Hashemite kingdom, which before was only on the east bank of the river. So none of them wanted a Palestinian state, and both wanted to have Palestine in their kingdom, and the same applied to their successor, King Hussein of Jordan. For many years had very good relations with Israel, who saved him on many occasions, including in 1970, the Black September, when he fought the Palestinian organization. And the same went to his successor, King Abdallah. For example, in 2000, when Ehud Barak was negotiating with Clinton in Camp David, and he was willing to give, to make substantial concessions to the Palestinians, including the Jordan Valley, which separates between the West Bank and the East Bank. The Jordanians sent covert messages to Israel not to do so. They are extremely upset. So Jordan definitely doesn't want a Palestinian state. They absorbed a lot of Palestinians in the 48 war. Most of the population is Palestinian, and they know that if there would be a Palestinian state, they'll undermine the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Egypt never wanted a Palestinian state, and part of the reason they attacked Israel in 48 was to prevent Abdallah from taking Palestine for himself. And the same continued afterwards. President Nasser, who was supposed to be the champion of the Pan-Arab cause throughout history, was on record for many years opposing the idea of Palestinian separate identity and so on and so forth. And in fact, it was quite a well-known fact in 48 that had Israel lost the war, its territory would have been divided by the invading forces. The same applies to Iraq, even under the rule of the Baath Party, which is a nationalist Pan-Arab party. Saddam Hussein for many years pretended to be champions of the Palestinians, but whenever things came to the crunch, he dropped the Palestinian issue in favor of his own interests. So in this respect, it's not very surprising that the Arab states didn't want a Palestinian state. The interesting thing is that the Palestinian leaders themselves didn't want a Palestinian state. I mean, the founding father of what is normally considered the Palestinian national movement, the religious leader, Haj Amin Husseini, he was the Mufti of Jerusalem, the supreme religious authority in Palestine from the 20s to the late 40s, despite the fact that his religious credentials were very thin indeed. He was originally a Pan-Arabist. He wanted Palestine to be annexed to Syria. The first pogroms against Jews in 1920, April 1920 in Jerusalem, by the Palestinian Arabs, were not designed to promote Palestinian statehood, but rather to facilitate the incorporation of this territory into Syria. And the Arab Higher Committee that he established, the unofficial government of the Palestinian Arabs, referred to Pan-Arab terminology as late as 1937, when the British suggested for the first time to partition Palestine between Arabs and Jews. So they opposed it not because they thought that the Jewish part belonged to the Palestinian Arabs, but rather because they thought that it belonged to the wider Arab nation. And during World War II, Haj Amin Husseini spent most of the time in Germany helping Hitler. And when he negotiated with Hitler, I mean, he met him personally in one very famous meeting, and then he served him. He was a very close associate of Himmler, for example. But he didn't present himself as leader of the Palestinians. He presented himself as leader of the Arabs. And in a way, he was pushing the Nazis, after winning the war, to establish a unified Arab empire in the Middle East, which he hoped to head. So in a way, you see that even the head of the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian National Movement at the time, Arab, Palestinian Arab National Movement, was not really interested in Palestinian independence. Then in the mid-60s, the PLO was established in 64. It was established by Egypt, you know, as a tool in Pan-Arab games. And the leader, The first leader of the PLO was a guy by the name of Ahmed Shukeri. His family resided in Palestine for some time, but he was basically of mixed parentage, Egyptian, Hijazi, North African, so he didn't have anything that really linked him organically to Palestine. And even he was basically a stooge in Nasser's hands, so long as he was the head of the PLO. And then in 69 came the ubiquitous Yasser Arafat. And under him, the PLO became the sole representative of the Palestinian people, but even Arafat was not really interested in establishing a Palestinian state. He was a good friend of the Romanian, deposed Romanian dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu. And there's interesting revelations where Arafat confided to him that he really didn't believe in the establishment of the Palestinian state. He said it would be a failure from day one. And when he got the opportunity to implement the vision to establish a Palestinian state in 1993 in the Oslo Accords, he made sure that it would be a failure. And instead of laying the groundwork for establishing a Palestinian state, he turned the territories under his control. First the Gaza Strip, which he got already in 94, and then the populated areas in the West Bank, which he got in 95-96. So in fact, the Israeli so-called occupation ended in 96-97, but of course the world hasn't noticed it, partly due to Israel's failure to get it to world attention. But Arafat, during these years, transformed the territories not to a Palestinian state in the making, but to a terrorist entity. At the beginning, he let Hamas, the religious militant organization Hamas, carry out the terror, and the smaller religious organizations carry out terrorist attacks against Israel, and then he did it directly at a certain point when he was offered the state by Ehud Barak in July 2000 in Camp David. Ehud Barak offered the Palestinians, by their own accounts, not by Israeli accounts, 92% of the West Bank and the entire Gaza Strip, and offered to compensate them with Israeli territory for most of the West Bank territories. He offered Jerusalem as the capital of the Palestinian, of the Palestinian state that would be established, and so on and so forth. And Arafat rejected it and launched the war of terror in September 2000, better known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada. But of course, it's not Intifada. Intifada in Arabic means something like uprising. It wasn't uprising because there was no one to rise against because Israel didn't control them. It was a war of terror, but this is again another Palestinian propaganda success. So Arafat, in fact, was brought to lay the groundwork for a Palestinian state. He didn't do anything about this. Then he died in 2004, came Mahmoud Abbas, his fellow PLO leader. Okay, he doesn't walk around in uniform and doesn't have a gun at his hip, but on the whole, his vision is very similar to Arafat. And even Abbas did very little to establish a Palestinian state during this time. The Palestinian Prime Minister, Fayyad, over the last couple of years, began making some moves in this direction, but again, there are a lot of people who are very critical. So in this respect, you see that the Palestinians from Haj Amin Husseini, through Arafat, through Mahmoud Abbas, have never really shown real interest in establishing their own state, and showed more interest in basically undermining the Jewish national cause, whether it was pre-state or post-state. Now we come to the documents that were released the last few days, and they relate basically to the negotiations that were carried on between the Palestinians and the Olmert government over the last 3 years or so. Now, again, this is completely new and we cannot be 100% sure about their authenticity. I mean, the Palestinian leadership already denied the veracity of these documents and they said that nothing described existed. What he described there is that basically the Israeli team, headed by Tzipi Livni, who was the foreign minister at the time, and Ahmed Kurai or Abu Ala, who is one of the architects of the Oslo process, they negotiated the possibility of territorial compromise, the two state, as we call it, the two state solution. And according to some of the transcripts, the Palestinians were amenable that some areas in eastern Jerusalem would remain in Israeli hands, like Ramot Eshkol, you know, the French Hill, where the Hebrew University, close to the Hebrew University, and so on and so forth. More or less along the Clinton parameters of 2000, what Jewish in East Jerusalem would remain Jewish, what Arab would remain Arab. But they didn't agree to other things, they didn't agree to the settlement blocks and so on and so forth. But this is an indication of some concessions. And if these concessions were, supposed concessions were truly made, and if they really meant it, because, you know, when you negotiated with the Palestinians, who have a very long experience, that they can tell you something and then they'll disown it a few days later or a few weeks later or a few months later. But if they really meant it, and if they really said it, and if they really meant it, it might indicate that some people in the Palestinian leadership begin thinking in terms of statehood. But the interesting thing is the reaction. You see that they came immediately under barrage of criticism in the Arab world. They're immediately accused of betraying the Palestinian cause. Why? Because they agreed to some territories in Jerusalem, which there is no force in the world which will really remove Israel from there, like Ramot Eshkol. I can think of no force that can change the demographic reality there. They agree to really minimal concessions in return for much wider concessions by Israel that might lead to Palestinian statehood. So what's wrong with it? And still, many people in the Arab world accuse them of treason, which indicate that these critics are not really interested in the Palestinian state. They are just interested in perpetuating the conflict and pretending to protect Palestinian rights. There are some other indications, again, which is still very new, but there is, for example, one document in which Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, he speaks at the Palestinian Institute, and there is some Palestinian who asks him, apparently he's an Israeli Arab, the Israeli Arabs call themselves Israeli Palestinians this day, and he said, I'm a resident of Nazareth, and should there be a Palestinian state, would I get a Palestinian passport? And he said, no, you're not going to get Palestinian passport. You stayed in the 48 territory. That's how they call Israel, basically, I mean, in the Palestinian jargon, and protect Palestinian rights within the 48 territories. Now, of course, the question is, what does he mean? First, it shows that basically the Palestinian state is not interested in making the Israeli Arabs their own citizens. They're not really interested in like, you know, in the case of Israel, you have the law of return and every Jew can come. They don't tell him, no, no, you stay here and only this and these Jews can come. So in a way, they exclude the entire Palestinian or Arab population of Israel from the Palestinian state. And secondly, they want them to stay there and continue to protect Arab rights. What does this exactly mean? Probably a fifth column. But again, these documents are very new. Their veracity has yet to be ascertained, but at least for those who want a two-state solution, maybe, a big maybe, they can offer a small glimmer of hope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chaim. I'm Daniel Pipes, Director of the Middle East Forum. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Murray, for hosting us. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I will moderate the questions and answers, and I will start with an observation and question. My observation is that over the century plus of Zionism, the response has changed over time, and that the first response was pan-Syrian. You alluded to it, the idea of a greater Syria. And the second was pan-Arabism, the idea of a single Arab state from the Atlantic Ocean to the Persian Gulf. And the third was Palestinianism, Arafat in his glory days, 70s, 80s, 90s. And the new one is Islamism, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. So there have been four different and important responses to the effort to create, and finally to create, a Jewish state. I offer that as background. In the foreground, I'm not quite sure. You intimated a number of times that Pan-Syrianism, Pan-Arabism were the goals of someone like, for example, Haj Amin al-Husseini. He wasn't really a Palestinian nationalist, he was an Arab nationalist. But then I hand in the last sentence, just quickly before switching to the new leaks, you said their goal is to undermine Israel. Well, which is it? Is it to create a Arab-Syrian Islamic alternative, or is it to snuff out Israel?
I mean, the two are not mutually exclusive. I mean, part of the Arab rejection of Zionism from the beginning is because in the world of Islam, in the Islamic historical memory, Jews were always what's called in Muslim societies the protected minorities or the Zimis. They know the Jews as a religious community, not as a nation, and it's very difficult for Muslims, and by extension Arabs, to envision Jews as a nation. And secondly, as Zimis, the non-Muslim communities in the Islamic order of things have always a very well-defined role as a legally, institutionally discriminated communities. Another place in the world of Islam, they are down, the Muslims are up, and there are a whole legal and political and social regulations which are implemented to varying degrees of strictness throughout history, how these people should behave. Now, historically, the Muslims have come to accept the fact that Christianity is a major world power, and sometimes the Christians have the upper hand. And Muslims community have come to live under Christian domination, you know, going back to the Crusades or even earlier. It doesn't mean they like it, but they can accept it. But never throughout history have Muslims lived under Jewish control. And part of the historical rejection of Zionism was this, that they couldn't envisage Muslims becoming a minority in a Jewish state. And you have, for example, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who thought as a pan-Arabist and as a pan-Islamist in a way, because his frame of reference was Islamic, despite the fact that he was really a phony cleric. I mean, in many ways, he was not at all a religious authority. He was chosen to his position through machinations. But he's on record on several occasions that he said, we will never become a minority in a Jewish state. So they wanted to undermine the Jewish cause in order to establish, to pave the way to the establishment of wider empires, whether it's Abdallah, Faisal, or the Egyptians, or, as in the case of Hamas, for example, as the first state to the establishment of the Islamic Ummah, or Caliphate, as people use it in a more popular term. For Hamas, by the way, which is a Palestinian so-called national resistance movement, it's not a national resistance movement, it's truly an Islamic movement first. So for them, the destruction of Israel is a stepping stone towards the wider unification of the Arab world. So to come back, I don't see any contradiction between the two.
Let me put it more specifically. Were the Palestinian Authority successful in eliminating Israel, don't you think they would seek to create a Palestinian state, or do you think they would want an Arab, Syrian, or Islamic state?
I mean, the Palestinian Authority at this stage, in any case, are not capable of doing it because the Hamas is better, so it's you get me off the hook quite easily. But Hamas will definitely not a Palestinian state. But let's say if Mahmoud Abbas tomorrow had a say, he might have established a Palestinian state, not necessarily because he wants it, but because, you know, it comes by default. So the issue is not, he doesn't care so much about the Palestinians having their state, but if by way of destroying Israel, the result will be a Palestinian state, so be it. So that's the approach.
In your talk, you mentioned Salam Fayyad. And could you expand on your comments? Because it seems to me, from what I've read, that with his background in economics, he's he's really made significant strides in improving the situation of the Palestinians in the West Bank, and as a consequence of as I understand it, of the steps that he's taken, the checkpoints have been eliminated, and there's now free flow of people from the West Bank into northern Israel. Do you see him as someone who genuinely would like to establish a Palestinian state? Is he a different breed of Palestinian?
So the question is about Salam Fayyad, the Palestinian prime minister, whether he's a different breed of politician. And he has been attempting over the past couple of years to carry out some structural reforms. I think Salam Fayyad may be a different brand of politician, but he's not the typical one. I mean, he's not an elected prime minister. Let's keep things in mind. I mean, people are talking about a democratic Palestinian state, but there is no way it's going to be democratic. I mean, even now, the so-called political parties, Fatah or PLO, and the Hamas are armed gangs. I mean, they are contesting power through election at the same time that they are shooting their opponents in the kneecaps and throwing them from tall buildings. So this is Palestinian democracy. I mean, this is happening in Gaza and may well happen in the West Bank. Now, Salam Fayyad ran to parliament when the elections were held there in 2006. And he ran and he won two seats out of 200 something. Him and Hanan Ashrawi. Hanan Ashrawi, meanwhile, left. So it's basically one main party was taken by President Abbas to be prime minister. I don't think in most democratic societies you will have a single member of parliament who represents himself become a prime minister. And by the way, Mahmoud Abbas's term in office expired more than a year ago, but he still remains there because the West and Israel and other international players don't really want elections to be held, because probably there will be some kind of Islamist president there tomorrow. And as I said, democracy is not what they care about. Now, Fayyad got the point that in order to have a state, you have to start from down, go from down up. You have to have state institutions. I mean, the Palestinians got billions of dollars since Oslo from the international community under Arafat and Abu Mazen. And what did they do? They didn't build a single hospital, a single school, you know. So Fayyad, who worked in the West before and basically came to the territories as an acceptable face, I understand that he has to make at least things that are acceptable to the international community, that he can come to them and say, look, we have an infrastructure for a Palestinian state, and he did certain things. Now, I'm not following it that closely, but there have been some people doing more CSO research, including a professor called Nathan Brown from George Washington University, who is by no means a friend of Israel, and he was very critical of Salam Fayyad, and he think that basically it's a show dressing. We have an article in the latest issue of Middle East Quarterly of what the Palestinians themselves are saying online in all these social networks. And you see that most Palestinians think that Salam Fayyad is just a puppet of the West that is not really making efforts toward true reform. So I know that Tom Friedman thinks very highly of him. But my thumb rule is, whatever Tom Friedman thinks, do the opposite and you'll be right.
David?
Do the U.S. presidential advisors, are they aware of the Arab anti-Palestinian state sentiments? And if not, why not? And if so, then why do the presidential administrations continue to pursue a policy for the establishment of a Palestinian state that is doomed to failure?
Good question. I mean, some of them are possible. Some advisors are possibly aware. I mean, if you read the WikiLeaks, you know, a couple of months ago, you know, these hundreds of thousands of U.S. documents released by the WikiLeaks online website, so you see that the American diplomats in various countries, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, other countries, send reports to Washington, which indicate that basically the Arabs don't care very much about the Palestinians. For example, there was the Iranian issue. I mean, part of the Obama's thesis was that if we solve the Arab-Israeli problem, the Arabs would come along the anti-nuclear Iran coalition. And you see from this leaked document that basically the Saudis have been pushing the Americans for years to attack Iran and destroy the nuclear reactor, regardless of what's happening. So some diplomats see it and some don't. And you have the quotes that I started the lecture, you know, the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, and obviously he doesn't see the point. So this is a very strong myth, basically, that the Arab-Israeli conflict is at the heart of the problems in the Middle East, and if you solve it, so it will be all milk and honey. It's not going to be, because in the Middle East you have several axes of crisis. Religious one is the most powerful, probably. And the Arab-Israeli conflict is just a diversion for most Arab regimes on which they can, the lowest common denominator around which they can unify publicly, and which can divert the attention of their population from their own situations.
I'd like to contest that last
thing. Okay.
I think that was true, say, in the 1950s, that Arab regimes, many of them new, used anti-Zionism as a mechanism to mobilize popular opinion, to get them to think about other things than their own circumstances. But I think that's completely reversed now. And you have leaderships that are more accommodating than populations. And then when something goes wrong in the Arab-Israeli arena, you have demonstrations and anger that the governments are just trying to hold down. And indeed, the events of the last couple of days with these leaks would again point to that. Here you have the various PA negotiators talking Turkey with the Israelis, quite realistically, at least if it's true. Anyway, true or not, the reaction to them has been one of outrage against Al Jazeera, Qatar, and the PA, that they're betrayed. So over and over again you see that governments, and indeed the PA itself, is more accommodating than populations. In other words, it's worse than it used to be. It used to be if you could just get the leadership in line, you'd have prospects of a resolution. Now the leaderships can't control their populations.
Okay, I mean, we are entering a debate now, but I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, on the one hand, you can say that, to begin with, I mean, why are the populations radicalized? Because they've been basically brainwashed by the leadership.
Right.
You know, it worked. And then you have, you know, in a way, a vicious circle that, you know, where do you break it? Because, you know, I mean, what does an Arabic-speaking person in Sana'a in Yemen have in common with the person in Palestine? Nothing. They don't even understand each other completely. They have such diverse accents and dialects and so on and so forth. So yes, I mean, the Arabs have been using it and they inflamed their population. But you had these problems already in the 40s and 50s. I mean, you know, it was very easy to get people to the streets, and sometimes they got on their own because, you know, you have even documents in 48 war that some of the leaders said, look, you know, we moved our armies, and if we move them back, you know, how can we then face our people after we told them it's such an important issue to confront the Zionists? So even now, I think that in the... Okay, you have internet, you have other means of communication that's accessible to the masses, and it's becoming maybe more difficult to control them in a very strict way. But even today, I think, in most Arab countries, I don't think the ordinary citizen really cares. Again, I mean, it's debatable. But look even in the West Bank. I mean, before Arafat came, these people were under Israel control, and they are more amenable to peace. Okay, they've been under Arafat, and now they are more difficult, and the regime may get it out of control. But again, I think if the regime takes a certain direction, it can influence the population. So I personally don't see a proof on the ground that you see the ordinary Arabs care more about the Palestinians than they did before. There was this poll, which I use as the hook for this New York Times article I wrote a few months ago, in which most Arabs said that they didn't, most interviewees said that they don't care really about the peace process or the Palestinians, whether they get a state or not. They just want to forget about this. Now, I've come under attack by James Zogby and others that this kind of surveys, online surveys, not as good as a supposedly scientific poll held. I don't know. I think it's representative. I mean, there are 9,000 people who responded to this poll. I'm not a statistician, but I'm sure if you have similar polls, I think they'll come to similar results. Again, it depends on the situation. If suddenly something dramatic happens, people can be very, you know, emotional and respond. But this poll was taken at a relatively calm period, that there is nothing dramatic happening, and most people didn't care. So I don't know. I mean, maybe you are right, but I haven't seen evidence of this.
Okay.
Marilyn. This is a point of history. In the 50s, it seems that there wasn't a whole lot of information about what was happening on the ground with the Palestinians themselves. The Muslim Brotherhood had already been established. It didn't seem like there was any movement afoot or any leadership emerging. So what exactly was going on in the Palestinian populations? Were they being suppressed by Jordan and Egypt for any kind of independent movement? Were they just waiting for a leader to emerge to rile them up? Were they equally led? Or was it an act of suppression? What was going on in the
questions about 1950s when there was no real Palestinian activism?
Yes, I mean, Jordan occupied the territory that came to be known as the West Bank, and they annexed them to Jordan in 1950. So these people, as of April 1950, became Jordanian citizens, and the Jordanian state did its utmost to basically eliminate any traces of Palestinian Arab identity. On the one hand, they're discriminated against, you know, in allocation of resources and so on and so forth. On the other hand, they're being Jordanized, and the elites were incorporated into the Jordanian state system. You have, for example, Nusseibah, Anwar Nusseibah, famous example, the father of the Sari Nusseibah, who is president of Al-Quds University, was minister of defense for a long time, but many others like him. So in Jordan, basically, they truly wanted to make them Jordanians, because in any case, Jordan is a very large country with very small population, and the Palestinian influx of people, they needed the body count. So they eliminated any traces of Palestinian identity. Now in Egypt, they didn't bother to annex it. They just held them under military regime and suppressed them. In the 50s, they used them against Israel as basis for attacks against Israel, the so-called Fidayun, the people who sacrificed themselves. And
there was no evidence of any real nationalists?
No. And again, I mean, paradoxically, Israel saves the Palestinians in historical junctures. I mean, unwittingly at times, like 48. I mean, had Israel lost the war, its territory would have been divided among the Arabs. There is no doubt about this. There is abundant evidence in documents of the time. And then nobody would have been speaking about Palestinians, because they would have disappeared. Part of Israel would have been Jordan, part Egypt, part Syria. So in a way, by surviving the war in 48, it's the Palestinians call it the Nakba, the catastrophe. But in fact, Israel saved the Palestinian national movement. Not intentionally, but that's what happened. And the same in 67. Israel took the territories. In 67, nobody really discussed the Palestinians. When you go to Resolution 242, for example, November 67, the name Palestinian, the word Palestinians, doesn't appear there. They speak about refugees, but this can relate to the Jewish refugees of the 48 war as well. I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of Jews, you know, who as a result of the 48 war were pushed from the Arab world. And he doesn't speak about establishment of Palestinian state. Basically, he speaks about withdrawal from territory. It's not the territory. And the idea was that basically Jordan will retake the West Bank. And Egypt probably or not might retake Gaza. But as a result of the political dynamics in subsequent years. The PLO came into being, Arafat, and others. Suddenly there is a Palestinian national movement, and the Palestinians are again actors. So 67, Israel saved them again from oblivion. And then again, the most important time frame was the Oslo. I mean, the Palestinian movement again was on the verge of extinction because Arafat made disastrous decisions. The latest of them was to side with Saddam Hussein after he invaded Kuwait. As a result of this, virtually all Palestinians who lived in and worked in Kuwait, some of them for decades, we are talking about 400 plus thousand people who were expelled from Kuwait and they are pushed to the desert in Jordan, in Iraq, and so on. And no one in the Arab world was willing to speak to Arafat. And had Yitzhak Rabin not agreed to, okay, he was maneuvered by Peres and Yossi Begin, but had he not chosen to bring the PLO into the picture, the PLO might have disappeared and some other actors might have re-emerged. Maybe Jordan again as the potential owner of the West Bank, or maybe the people in the West Bank themselves would have become an independent actor. So at least three historical junctures, Israel has saved the Palestinians and put them on the road to statehood, and it remains to be seen if it will be completed.
Very interesting. David.
How dangerous do you think the delegitimization movement is, particularly as it's directed at Western audiences to undermine support for Israel?
How important is the delegitimization movement?
I think it's very important, and I think it's making waves. I think in many ways Israel has lost the battle, definitely in Europe. They may not realize it. In fact, I'm not sure they never really joined it in a real way. I mean, this is a personal passion of mine. I mean, I've been talking about this for a decade now and trying to bring certain groups and people and organizations and parts of the Israeli government to take some action. I won't say that I've been very successful in this. I think the battle has moved to the United States to an extent as well. And again, I think these days the Israeli government is more aware of it. I mean, you have Vice Prime Minister Moshe Yaalon charged with this specific task, but and I have some personal friends who are working on it under his leadership. But even they, you know, when you speak to them, you don't get the impression that they see the full extent of the problem. And to an extent, there is some complacency in Israel that the U.S. arena is relatively secure and you cannot lose, you know, ground to the Arabs, which may be right in the immediate term, but I'm not sure in the long term. So I think this trend is as dangerous this day as the Arab military might, because in the final account, the Arabs haven't been able to destroy Israel by force, and they know it. And the battle is political, media battle over public opinion. The Palestinians, the Arabs are putting great, they're investing major resources in it, at least in England, you see it. They go to universities, they buy chairs, they buy centers, they bring the people in, they bribe journalists, I mean indirectly, of course, they buy them and so on and so forth, and they work. They have their people going around, touring the country, speaking. On the other side, you don't have any responses. So it's a very worrisome phenomenon, and as I said, the only glimmer of hope is that the Israeli government has recognized it to an extent, and hopefully we'll fight back.
As I like to put it, who would have imagined 100 years ago in 1911 that Jews would be the great soldiers and Arabs the great publicists?
Maybe not. I'm saying that the Palestinians themselves don't necessarily want a state, but you know, very recently, and back also in the 1980s, Palestinians have been trying to declare unilaterally a state, have gone now toward the UN, and a lot of countries are starting to recognize the state without any borders. So can you comment on that, number one, and number two, what Israel should do about it?
What about the effort to get Palestine recognized at the United Nations, and what should Israel do about it?
I mean, you're right. In 1988, I mean, the PLO declared a Palestinian state and some state recognized it. But as I said, Arafat in his behavior proved that, I mean, these declarations really didn't live up to reality. I mean, he got the chance to establish his own state. I mean, he was established on the ground. And had Arafat really lived to his international obligations under the Oslo Accords, he signed 5-6 agreements with Israel, you know, very detailed agreements, there would have been a Palestinian state today. I mean, there is no reason that it wouldn't have been. I mean, the original agreement spoke about 5 years. What's the big deal? I mean, you just go there, don't kill Jews, and focus on building schools and hospitals and taking care of your people, educate them properly. He didn't do it. So yes, he declared a state, and there may be a state tomorrow, but it's not really a state. It's what we call a failed state or a semi-state. Now, I think it's a very alarming development, because I think the Palestinians are now heading in this direction, because they want to avoid the negotiation, they want to avoid any concessions. So their strategy is to have the international community declare a Palestinian state, and then once they have their state, they'll continue try to encroach on Israeli territory. They'll have the Arab minority living in parts of Israel, which is one of the reasons that Mahmoud Abbas is not keen to make them Palestinian citizens, and they'll continue. I mean, I think there is a real danger in this respect. I mean, many states these days are willing to support this line. This is part of the reason that Fayyad, the Palestinian prime minister, at least pretends to create infrastructure that will justify it. A lot depends on America. I mean, will the U.S. administration, I mean, the Palestinians apparently want to bring it to the U.N. General Assembly in next September, September 11. I mean, will the U.S. veto it, the Obama administration? Will it not? It's certain to me that if the world will support this state and it will be established, it's a recipe for trouble, because of course you have the Israeli people living in this territory. What are you going to do with them? Are you going to do the ethnic cleansing of all the so-called settlers who live in the West Bank? You are talking about hundreds of thousands of them, or the state, then you have to ensure their safety and security under Palestinian control. And who is going to control the territories? Hamas, the PLO. I mean, you know, you're going to turn the West Bank into a terrorist entity that will endanger Israel's very existence. So the only way, in my view, which again I am quite skeptical about the feasibility of culminating in a solution, but the only way is through bilateral negotiations that the two parties reach a mutually acceptable solution and live to it. But as I said, the historical record doesn't inspire much confidence.
We happen to have Stephen Rosen with us in the audience, who is the expert on American vetoes in the United Nations. Care to say a word or two about what you see coming?
Well, thanks. There's a more immediate challenge for Obama. The resolution that they have brought this week, it's not yet about statehood. This resolution is about settlements. And they have tried to corner Obama by using some of his own words and to recraft them in the form of a Security Council resolution and dare him to veto. To be accurate, the resolution goes a little beyond Obama. It declares the settlements to be illegal. It has not been of the Obama administration that the settlements are illegal. They're an obstacle to peace, but not illegal. So it goes a little further. But he is in a corner. And what he does with this resolution will probably be a precursor of how he's going to manage a statehood resolution in September at the UN Security Council. If he musters the courage to veto this resolution, he will have broken this psychological barrier against vetoes. You know, he was elected on this multilateralist, working with allies, not being a unilateral cowboy platform. And so the veto sits pretty heavy with him. But if he overcomes this, what I call veto reticence, he may be in a better position. And as you did say, the only way to force the parties, especially the Palestinians, back to bilateral negotiations is to close the door to what they imagine is this other alternative of having the world community, you know, do everything for them and deliver Israel on the silver platter. Bill Clinton did veto two resolutions on settlements at the UN Security Council, while Reagan vetoed three. The only American president who ever voted for one was Jimmy Carter, probably not company Obama wants to put himself in facing 2012. But watch this space, because anything could happen. There is a tremendous pressure campaign on Obama not to veto the settlements resolution. And if he lets this one pass, it will send a signal about the statehood resolution that, as you say, is coming in September. By its tiny point, though, a prime you said accidentally, the General Assembly, I think he meant the Security Council.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Time for one more question.
J Street is one, but there's this whole raft of former State Department officials, Arabists, and former ambassadors, and with a sprinkling of Republicans, maybe five or six Republican names, that gives it slightly more credibility, pushing him to allow the spread to vote for the resolution, or at least to abstain and allow it to pass. An abstention lets it pass. Abstention is almost the same as voting for.
Okay.
It seems that there are two trends and more, but one of the trends is the European defeatism about the ability, the power of diplomacy to come to an agreement. Is it not clear that the Europeans are moving towards sacrificing Israel in the hopes of satisfying the Arabs, which is a great concern? And the other trend is if Israel goes down, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan will go down. And that is very, very bad for American interests, European interests, Chinese interests. So which trend is going to win?
All right. I mean, neither. I mean, I don't want Israel to go down. And I mean, the Europeans basically sacrificed, as you say, Israel a long time ago. I mean, it's nothing new. It's at least since 67 even. You remember De Gaulle, the Israeli-French alliance. And, you know, Israel attacked Egypt in June, and then he forgot everything about this. So Europe has been on the Arab side for a long time, with a few exceptions. Germany at times were a bit more reserved, some British prime ministers at times, and so on and so forth. The other one, I don't know what you mean going down. I mean, Egypt is a long country throughout history. It's not going to, you mean probably the military junta that has ruled Egypt since the 50s, they may go down even if Israel exists or not. But Egypt will stay forever, at least in human terms, whether it's ruled by another junta or whether it will become more democratic, or maybe the Islamists will take over, it remains to be seen. Saudi Arabia, I cannot really prophesy. I guess the United States will try to ensure the remaining power, because they are a close ally of the United States. So in other words, just as I said, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not the source of all problems, so then the disappearance of Israel will not lead to the fundamental transformation of the Middle East, apart from the fact that certain countries are going to increase their territory.
Speaking of fundamental transformations in the Middle East, we're undergoing quite a transformation these days. The events in Tunisia of some days ago, a new country has appeared, the South Sudan. Turkey is changing. Made significant developments in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. It's a region that is, as ever, volatile and important to ourselves. We are here at the Middle East Forum to keep an eye on it for you. We have a number of our staff here. Ephraim is editor of the Quarterly. Stephen Rosen, who spoke before, is head of our Washington project. David Russin heads Islamist Watch. David, there you are, in the back. Who am I missing? Judy Goodrob is the managing editor of the Middle East Quarterly. And am I missing? Amy Schreigel, of course, in the back. Everyone knows Amy.
Legal project.
A legal project, yes. And Snyder is part of our legal project, which protects those of us who talk about these issues. So we're here. We thank you for joining us today. Again, thank you to Pepper Hamilton.